Hello and welcome to AgTech So What, brought to you by the AgVendit Group. I'm Sarah Nolette. When you think of the stereotype of a quote-unquote regenerative farmer, my next guest, Lauren Steinlogge, may not exactly fit the image that comes to mind. Lauren, who farms in Iowa, has been tinkering with ag machinery for as long as he can remember. So when he started looking more into soil health and practices such as cover cropping and relay cropping, he started tweaking equipment to make it do the new jobs he needed it to. Now, other farmers and even machinery manufacturers are paying attention to his innovations. It's Lauren's understanding of farming, machinery, business, and soil health at an in-depth and practical level that's helped him to tackle some big farming and tech challenges. Like, Lauren has a system that allows him to grow a crop 365 days a year, even under snow. But Lauren became motivated to share his innovations for very personal reasons. After his son, Roland, was diagnosed with a brain tumor at the age of 12.
As soon as Roland got sick, I realized that chances are the farm could die with me. And I just said, I'm not a selfish person. I'm going to start sharing ideals. And the next thing you know, when you start sharing ideals, more people share ideals with you. And it just snowballs from there.
In fact, Lauren has had to overcome multiple life-changing events and adapt as a result. The first one happened when he was just a newborn baby.
My dad moved here in 1968, and then I was born a year later. About 6 weeks after I was born, he was burnt 75% over his body. And the doctors and everybody told him he'd pretty well never farm. But he quickly figured out that his only option to keep farming was to fully automate. And we went from bucket milking to pipeline, fully automated feeding systems and all that. And, you know, that trend just kept progressing all the way up and through the 80s. And he was one of the survivors of the 80s. He never really got overextended. So coming out of the farm crisis in the 80s, he was in a position he could start buying land and stuff like that. He always had the attitude, if it ain't fun, we're not going to do it. You know, every one of us kids came home to farm. I got a brother and three sisters. You know, some of them have now moved on from farming since, but he started every one of us farming at least twice was the joke we always had.
You said your dad was focused on making sure it was fun. What's an example? Do you have any kind of early memories of farming being fun?
Oh, just, I don't know. You know, you never made things hard work. You know, if it was mundane and hard work, we just figured out a better way to do it. And that was kind of instilled in me in an early age. So, you know, everything I do anymore is how to become more efficient, how to get by with about as little help as possible. And I was pretty well focused about 10th grade already. We got a 12th grade system here in the States. About 10th grade already, I was pretty well focused that I was going to go home and farm. You know, and our class had 117 kids in, and I was the only one that was going to go straight home to farm. But I always told everybody I was going to stay all the way through graduation just to prove a point that, you know, like bankers and that, they'd see I wasn't afraid to commit. So I always joked that I graduated high school on a social degree. And, you know, my senior year in high school, I never went a full day.
As a teenager, Lauren started farming in partnership with his dad, Florian, creating Flo-Lo Farms. And while Lauren's father was his first teacher on how to be innovative in agriculture, Lauren also had to learn to adapt out of necessity when another one of those life-changing moments arrived. At the age of 14, while in a tractor, he was hit by a truck as it tried to pass him. Now, Lauren recovered from his injuries, but due to scar tissue, 10 years later, he found he just physically could no longer work with animals.
And that's when I had to decide, you know, I couldn't be around livestock anymore, so I started focusing on the row crop. You know, I always enjoyed the row crop production and equipment more than the livestock anyways. My forte is I love designing and building equipment, figuring out how to make stuff work better. That just, when the cows left, I focused hard on custom work. You know, in our peak, I was probably 2,500 acres between the custom work and our own work. Dad was still pretty heavily involved. My wife was, it was basically the three of us putting the crop in, taking it out every year. And well, 09 is when Roland got sick. And, you know, I was pretty hard corn on corn back in them days. You know, I just I didn't even think about it. I just called the grain buyer and said, hey, can we roll my corn contracts into bean contracts? Called the seed dealer, rolled all the seed in, and farming became easy that year. Our son had a 20% chance of living a year. That's basically what they told us. You know, so we just focused on living at that time. And the more removed I got from the farm, the more a guy learned how to time stuff, get stuff done quick, and then focus on the family. And this day yet, you know, I never thought I'd walk away from the farm as much as I do, but I just learned I become more efficient when you're more focused.
Hmm. Do you, it's such a tough one because you would never wish that, I imagine, on anyone to have such a, you know, a scare like that with your son and such a challenge. And yet you know, some good has come of it. It sounds like in, you know, farming differently and thinking about how you manage time differently. It is tough in agriculture. Like I talk to a lot of people who, and I fall prey to it myself, where it's like, you get so caught up in the day to day that you don't think about working smarter. It ends up being working harder. Do you think that's something that happens a bit in ag? Do you see that?
Oh, definitely. You know, everybody wants to be the best farmer in the world, but I've never met a bad farmer. That's kind of what drove me, you know, as I started meeting people around the world, everybody's trying to be the best. And I give credit to a friend in Australia, you know, he was here one time on a Nuffield scholarship, and you really get to know the guys when you sit there and talk to them. I said, what's your competition like in Australia? And he's like, listen, every farmer in Australia has got to be the best farmer in the world because we don't have subsidies and all that to help us survive. And that was probably one of the triggers that started making me realize we need to be pushing, doing better. You know, and one of them instances goes back to when we were doing the stuff with deer. Every year we'd have to go in for training. There was a relatively sizable farmer that was at the meetings every year. And me and him got to be pretty good friends and talk during the meetings, and he made the announcement during the meeting the one day as we're talking. He's like, yeah, we're to the point where people call us and want us to rent their farms. And I was like, okay, somebody comes and offers you your farm or their farm, what's the deciding factor? And he just put his finger up, $1. I was like, dollar an acre, you'll farm it? He's like, no, if it adds a dollar to the bottom line of the whole operation, he'll add it. And that was just like, I can't compete with that. You know, so that started going down more the specialty grains and stuff like that. As I said earlier, I love focusing on equipment. So learning how to fine tune equipment, getting the maximum quality during harvest and stuff like that has been probably one of the biggest boons for us. If we can capture premiums and stuff like that, or one of the favorite things I used to do is we used to sell a lot of beans direct to Korea. You know, soybeans for edamame and stuff like that. We used to, or the tofu beans, whatever they all were. But now I've had to back away from that because the guy's just getting too busy. You know, I'm hoping, you know, the next generation, I'm getting ready to step out of the way and let the next generation start handling that.
So there's a few things that I want to unpack a little bit more, Lauren. So you mentioned the, I guess, kind of decision to go more specialty. And it sounds like there's two things there. One is sort of efficiency and equipment and technologies. And one is also like actually farming different things or thinking about different markets. Tell me more about that. What are some examples?
Well, for me, they go hand in hand. I mean, once you start figuring out the efficiencies, you can also get the quality. Like I said, they go hand in hand, and we've got as high as a $3 bushel premium on soybeans over Chicago. So that would essentially be a strong $4 premium because we're in such a low basis area. So that's when we started, you know, well, through my son's deal, that's when we started, you know, forcibly losing acres. And we had landlords starting to walk away from us, and other guys seen a guy kind of down. So they were going after our land. But the neat part is they went after our worst land. You know, so we, our best land base, and you know, a lot less headaches. But I would say the farm itself, the last 5 years, has probably been more profitable at 750 acres than we ever were at 2,500 with all the custom. You know, I've totally dropped custom work and all that, or I guess you guys would call it contract work. But you know, I've totally dropped all that, and I just focus on our acres. And
so it sounds like focus, a bit of that kind of perspective and time management. What were some of the other keys there? You know, was it, you mentioned kind of changing over to beans. What else? What are other examples of things that you did that have led to that profitability?
Well, bringing the technology to full scale. I mean, you know, we had the auto steer and all that. And now everything's pretty much controlled traffic, tram lines of that. And we're getting by with very little herbicide. You know, essentially, we're becoming a low-cost producer. We used the cover crops and all that. About 06 is when we started playing with the cover crops and stuff like that. And that started helping us, you know, eliminate tillage and all that stuff. Once we started figuring out we didn't need the tillage to eliminate compaction and all that stuff.
What's key in all of this is that it's Lauren's knowledge of equipment that has enabled him to become a low-cost producer, targeting premiums and reducing costs rather than being stuck on the commodities treadmill. Without the ability to modify and adapt equipment, he'd be missing the unlock code to alternative farming practices and entering different farming markets. Lauren has won awards for his innovations, but he's still very modest about what he's achieved.
Oh, it's 2012 was the first time I was ever asked to do a public presentation. And, you know, when I was in school, they didn't have such a thing as PowerPoint and all that. So I had to have my daughter do my first PowerPoint for me and all that. I walked on stage it was a group of 100 engineers. I walked on stage and introduced myself as the unengineer. And, you know, it's just for what we're doing, usually traditional equipment doesn't work. So everything we've done, I've had to custom build or modify. Or back to when Roland got sick, it was to the point we had to have appraisers out to keep him insured. We had to have appraisers out to keep insurance on our kids and that. And the guy that did the appraisal wrote on there, there's only one way to force or one way to appraise this line of equipment is to force an auction, because none of it has standard value. I mean, only thing that was even close to remotely standard was the tractors, probably. And, you know, we did everything from the planters to the heads, you name it, were custom built.
And you did a lot of that work yourself. Give me an example or two of one you that's worked out well.
Probably the best one has been the no-till drill we built from the ground up in 2016. And, you know, that was the 10th drill we had built. And that was kind of when we really started getting the companion cropping and the interseeding all figured out. Well, we figured out once we had that key piece of the equipment, it set us up for the relay cropping. We could put fertilizer down with it. So we built that accordingly. And that's the one that really kind of sealed the deal that, you know, I got the job with Bowen equipment out of that deal.
It sounds like it's something I think about a lot. How do you bridge the gap between practical, like what's actually happening on the farm? What are the drivers? What's going to make more money, save more time, versus the people who are building the technologies, whether it's equipment or digital technologies? Like, they sometimes don't speak the same language. What's your experience been with kind of bridging the gap between those two?
That's kind of my position with Dawn, is to kind of help the engineers understand what's actually going on in the field. And, you know, I always go back to John Deere when through the years they had a history of hiring young farm kids and bringing them up through the country. And that's who they ended up as their designers in that. Well, they've kind of went away from that. And, you know, about, I don't even remember what year that was, but I had the opportunity to go to work for Deere, and we were at a field day with a bunch of the lead engineers. And they're like, you don't want to come and work for us anymore. You know, go to a company like Dawn. That's more responsive. You can actually have an impact. You know, Joe, as he's evolved, the whole underground ag line that I'm actually working for is strongly focused on the regen ag side and stuff like that. So, you know, it's pretty neat to see all this coming full circle. And now we've got manufacturers starting to look at the way we're doing stuff. And I'm optimistic about the future, I guess, on some of that.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, in the world I often live in, we're talking about, you know, people with robotics expertise and mechatronic engineers and machine learning programmers. And like, we absolutely need that skill set, but we also need that skill set to appreciate what's happening on the farm. And I know I've been in lots of hilarious conversations where people are talking over each other, and I'm one of them, I'm sure, but it's totally different skill sets. And yet we've got to find a way to meet in the middle somehow and kind of learn from what each other brings.
Well, you know, we've hit a point in life where Google is our best friend, but I'm also seeing it being some people's nemesis. It's so easy to find information, and people are afraid to seek that next level of information. They just take the easy answer and go with it because Google says. Well, I remember when we first started getting on Google, it seemed it was a lot more you could get better information now. Now it all seems filtered, and they aim it towards more what your rustier searches are. And you know, I kind of like going back to the old school, kind of the hard searches, and let's look in depth. And you know, as a high school graduate, it's pretty cool to be I found myself this past summer, spring and summer, studying fluid dynamics and stuff like that, trying to help figure out how some of the stuff we're engineering right now, how to help make it work. And well, that's kind of the fun part where I'm at right now. You know, it's one thing to have an ideal and build it for yourself, but to have that help develop an ideal and see it come to production.
And I guess part of that's, you mentioned a pivotal day in your career, kind of going from closed loop to open frame, but that's part of this, right? Is sharing these ideas with others so that they can get to more scale, I imagine.
Yeah. And I mean, I hate to keep going back to Rolland, but that was kind of that time frame. I was a very closed-minded person. You know, I was building, you know, I was going to farm the world at that time. And, you know, everything was proprietary, whatever you want to call it. And soon as Rolland got sick, I realized that chances are the farm could die with me. And I just said, I'm not a selfish person. I'm going to start sharing ideals. And the next thing you know, when you start sharing ideals, more people share ideals with you. And it just snowballs from there. And it's just neat to see where it's all taken us. You know, in a room of what I would consider some of the brightest people in the world and start bouncing ideals off of each other, we push each other at that point. You know, that's kind of the neat part where I see us, a bunch of us, starting to go. There's going to be some pretty cool things coming here, I'd say, within the next year now, that a bunch of us are going to team up and help push a few things. And
when you started thinking about sharing more, was it hard? Like, it strikes me that it's not easy to just change your mind and do something different than you've always done. Was that difficult?
No, it was just natural, because, you know, as I said, I spent 8 weeks in the hospital with my son. You know, my wife came home to daughters and I stayed in the hospital because we kind of figured I'd be the one that pushed him, you know, to keep his mind going and all that through the chemo and radiation and all that stuff. And, you know, we never spent a full day in the hospital or in the city. We'd always, every day we'd just pick a direction and go just to keep his mind going. And, you know, as I started seeing what was going on around that area, that's when I really started, you know, online. We had a presence online back then already with Ag Online or Successful, or way back then it was Successful Farming and then New Ag Talk. And, you know, I always said that's when my world started expanding. You know, I went from Fayette County, Iowa to North America. And then as them websites transitioned, you know, we started going international on that. You know, everybody asked me what's going on at home anymore. I haven't a clue. You know, what's this thing? I'm like, Dad, I don't know. You know, I can probably tell you more what's going on in Australia, France, Germany, or someplace like that than I can in West Union, Iowa. Mm-hmm. And I figured out that's a lot more relevant. I don't get hooked on petty stuff like a lot of people get hooked on the petty stuff, and I just don't care anymore.
Yeah. How's your son doing now?
Oh, it's been a heck of a ride. I mean, the it turned out long-term that the chemo and radiation, you know, the cancer was an easy battle. About 5 years after the chemo and radiation, and the worst part was anxiety set in. As one of his therapists described, his friends just got sick of him being sick. We've had to find different places, different facilities to get him in, get him the help. And then, you know, through our healthcare system, there's been a few major hiccups that have dropped the ball on him, but we keep fighting, and we've got a great new young therapist helping him out. I mean, he's in a brain injury rehab place there in Oklahoma that, you know, they did great the first year he was down there, especially with all the COVID crap.
I'm sorry to hear that. That does not, it sounds like a really, really up and down. Just the roller coaster of it all can't be easy.
I used to enjoy telling the whole Rolland story, but then when all hell broke loose, I kind of got quiet about it for 2 years. But now we're back to a point where I can freely talk about it because you start seeing the progress again. And
one of the things we were talking a little bit about this last week, but is agriculture is, I mean, it's the fact that we're even having this conversation about, you know, your family and what's happening and on a podcast about technology is just an insane thing about agriculture, how it is about families and it is about life. And some of that stuff's just not talked about enough. You know, we're like, oh, what decision did you make on paddock seven? And it's like, you're missing the bigger picture here of how this fits into humans and families. And yeah, it's just, it's such a unique industry in that sense.
Well, that's, you know, people are shocked when I say I'm ready to walk away from the management of farming and that, but since all that, both daughters have made it known that they want to be involved in the farm right now. And I guess I might as well be frank. I don't enjoy the management option anymore. It just, that's mundane. I like figuring out how to make things work and then let somebody else handle it. You know, that's part of what we're getting ready to look forward to in the future here, how we can help other people transition without offending. You know, that's what I see a lot of people adamant right now. It's this way or that way. Well, no, you've got to figure out where that person's comfortable with and help them push the boundary a little at a time instead of, you know, too many people want wholesale changes right now. And, you know, prices are good right now, but I'm in the mindset right now. I'm not going to overextend one bit.
When you say transition there, do you mean to things like no-till, or what do you mean? Or just like generally kind of improvements, or?
Well, no-till is a part of what we do. You know, I don't even really focus on cover crops anymore. You know, I call cover crops the gateway drug to what we're doing now with the relay cropping and that. Because once you start understanding some of that and you actually see it and working on your farm, I'm in the heart of the Corn Belt and I don't even care if I grow corn anymore. You know, everybody around here grows corn. Well, I can't compete with that. But now we've figured out the relay cropping here and I can run cash flows that would blow 250 bushel an acre corn away. I could probably make the guy that wants to grow 300 corn feel pretty sad with some of the cash flows we can run. My main focus is the cereal rye and soybeans. And then, you know, we're rotating out of corn right now. Mother Nature is probably going to make a liar out of me, but I'll probably keep some corn in the rotation yet just because, like this year, you know, I thought I had everything set up perfectly, but then late May there, we had a frost May 29th that we ended up replanting a lot of beans and that. So I'm hoping that didn't screw my plan up, but you know, but fluid management is the way I call it. You know, just we'll have a kind of a destination where we're going, but how we get there, nobody knows. Right now, I'm looking pretty hard. You know, I can make the cash flow with the relay beans. So we're rotating back and forth, relay beans and regular beans. Some guys are going to say, oh, you can't do that. But if you start seeing the soil health scores we can create with that system, it's working.
How do you think about making those decisions? Is it sort of agronomically driven, like you're saying, around soil and what makes sense to actually plant? Or is it more markets, as in this is kind of where we want to be headed in terms of consumers or different markets or prices? How do you think about the balance?
Well, right now, the main reason I'm pushing as hard as I am on the relay crop is because I think we got a window. You know, we have it figured out on my farm. I know some neighbors are starting to do what we're doing, so I figure I got a 5-year window before they catch up to me. And I hope in the next 5 years, I figure out something, the next best thing. I hate to say it that way, but you know, I don't want to get hooked in any one set pattern. But right now, you know, we've built the market for rye and as cover crop and that, and you know, we've got the reputation for quality seed and all that. I know I can hammer pretty hard here the next 5 years without much risk and much stress. And see what the neighbors do in 5 years. If they're catching up to me, you know, then heck, maybe by the time they're not growing corn anymore, I'll go back to corn. Or, you know, the sad part is that late frost kind of ruined a lot of our tests for this year. We tend to push the boundaries pretty hard. Well, this year, one of the things we were trying to do is grow vegetables in between corn. So essentially, we want to start turning our cover crops into cash crops. You know, I think we had the perfect setup, but again, May 29th frost, and then, you know, some of the testing we were doing on that field, instead of using herbicide, I burned the field off trying to control perennials and that. Well, we learned fire and ice is hard on perennial. You know, I jokingly started calling that the blackjack plot. Hit me one more time in 2021.
And Lauren doesn't just look at the soil health or the yields to know if his system is working. He says the answer can also be found in the water.
The trout is one of the most pleasant surprises we had in the last year. And I guess, you know, as I've been thinking about that since it's happened, I think it's age starting to catch up to me a little bit. You know, I used to condemn deer, turkey, rabbits, and all that when I'd see them in my field. But as you start getting older, you start appreciating more of that. And we had a lot of hurdles back in June, July. And Ross, the young guy that I work with on the multi-cropping Iowa project, he called me the one day and he said, "Hey, the DNR would like to come out and check your stream for trout." Cool. I never thought of trout in our creek. You know, I knew we've had fish in it ever since growing up and that. But it came out about a week or two before our field day, and they started stunning the trout so they could actually take inventory of what's there. And here we have native trout in our creek about 5 miles away from where they probably thought there should be trout. The only way you're going to have trout in a stream like that is you got cool, clear, good quality water. To me, that's the ultimate sign that what we're doing is working on our farm. Like I said, you know, then part of our field day, we had the DNR out and do it again. And then we had, the one night we had a bunch of kids out here. We showed them all the trout in the stream and all that. And if this keeps progressing, you know, they're monitoring our creek now. They're going to actually stock our creek with another species of native trout to try to help propagate the trout herd in Northeast Iowa. So, like I said, you can run all the tests you want, but when you see something like that happen, you know, one of the days of our field day this year, we had the Rodale Institute here. And by 2-3 days later, I got a letter from the head of the Rodale Institute saying, "I'm struggling to put a name on definition on regen agriculture." He's like, "But I think when I can stand in your creek and see trout where they're not supposed to be, that's a pretty good sign." And, you know, that's some little things I see in the future, you know. John Q. Public's paying attention to what we're doing, and that's the stories we've got to start telling. We as farmers got to step forward and tell what we're doing on the farm and, you know, start showing the positive light, not just letting people grab the negative light and showcasing that.
Yeah, what do you think about that? Is that a driver for you in terms of talking to the public and telling the stories? I mean, in one sense, I find that really compelling. Like there are amazing stories and people care about nature and the environmental aspects. In another sense, it's like, that's exhausting. Like you're already farming, you're running that business, having to have that conversation. And then I guess the third one is like, soon we'll have satellite imagery that is just knowing everything we want to know and the brands or whoever else is going to communicate about it. So I don't know, do you see that long-term as the role of the farmer?
I think we need to become self-advocates before we start getting dictated what we're going to do on the farm. I foresee, you know, everybody's hooked on the carbon credits, but the first thing I tell people is, you know, number one, we better be carbon, or I'm a proponent of the net zero initiative, I guess I'll put it that way, because what I'm worried is we as farmers are going to step forward and sell all our carbon credits when we're not even truly carbon neutral in the first place. So if United States steps forward and follows the Canadian model, we switch to a carbon tax, what's going to happen to your average farmer that sold all those carbon credits? And so I was asked to be on a net zero alliance initiative or whatever they want to call it for the local community college. And that's really helped me start understanding where things are going. And, you know, if you start really talking to the people in industry, I think your major players are going to start looking at the net zero alliance. And that's, I believe, and I volunteered our farm to run an audit to find out exactly where we're at on the net zero initiative. You know, because right now, you know, everybody's touting, "Oh, we're going carbon neutral." I don't think any of them have even realized what that's going to take to truly quantify that. On our personal operation, I want to get to the point where I'm not going to be afraid to say, "Hey, do I use a pen or a pencil?" And that sounds a little extreme, but I think to truly tell a story, that's where we're going to need to be.
What do you mean? Yeah.
Well, with the whole net zero, I mean, you know, I want to be able to say, "Hey, you know, we are actually, you know, my goal is to actually prove we're positive." I don't even know where we're going to be yet on that. So that's probably a bold statement, but, you know, that's part of the reason I want to do the relay crop for at least 5 years, because I think we can set a pretty strong baseline. You know, probably our biggest carbon burn right now is the nitrogen use on corn. You know, so if I can truly eliminate that, that's going to help us drastically right there. And, you know, focusing on crops that we don't need the nitrogen and stuff like that, or through some of our past testing with the clovers and stuff like that in our corn, you know, we've actually proved we can produce 80 pounds of nitrogen in a corn on corn situation. Even in a rotated field, we can do that now. You know, I was told this summer that, you know, legume ahead of soybeans is not a good idea, but we've done it. You know, we've maintained a legume crop since 2016 till last fall. You know, last fall, that field was going to be set up for relay again, so I finally felt comfortable taking that field out. But, you know, I also know that's one of the fields that we are testing hardest on carbon, and we can probably blow some pretty good numbers. You know, we're going to have some pretty strong numbers coming off of that field already. So for me, the key is start keeping that living plant in there 24/7 in Northeast Iowa. That takes a little thinking, because in the we kind of have a winter, and you know, we freeze up in December, and we probably the last couple of years we haven't thawed till April. But some of the data I'm reading and hearing shows that even if we have a, like a perennial cover in there, as long as it's green, even under snow cover, it's probably sinking some carbon. We had one of the major companies here a couple months ago have supper with the COO. And she's like, Warren, when I go back to the board Monday morning, what do you want me to tell the board? And I said, why don't you go back and tell them we screwed up? She looked at me and she's like, what do you mean? I was like, well, the way I look at it, you guys have spent a lot of money trying to quantify carbon. I can spend $8 on a water quality sample and prove that we're doing a good job. Now, if we solve the water issue, we solve the carbon issue at the same, you know, they go hand in hand. So if we solve the cycle, we solve the carbon cycle. And, you know, that's probably getting way beyond where you wanted to go today, but that's
no, it's fascinating. I mean, I think that kind of, those kind of indirect indicators, like right now we're stuck in this world, especially around carbon, of like, we've got to go out and measure every however many meters and dig cores however deep. And it's like, that just doesn't make sense, right? And it's not going to scale. Like we've got changes to make way faster than we can figure out how to scale digging cores.
Yeah. And it does, from what I've been reading and hearing, it all comes down to water quality. If you've got water quality, you've got carbon in the soil. And you know, that's, you know, we were fortunate enough back in July here at the field day, Dr. Rick Haney was here, and he kind of showed us his new test coming. It's going to be fun times. And, you know, that's part of that technology we were talking about the other day. I mean, that's why guys involved in some of this, you know, I know a few people condemn me for being so pro technology, but the way I look at it, if we can start doing things with technology that we can't do today, what's wrong with that? You know, last fall, we were seeding cover crops in standing corn with robots. We've used the drones for spraying. We've used, you know, all my relay rye this year was all maintained with the drone. And we can get cost competitive already with a plane. You know, ground rig is still cheaper, yes. But then when you have solid crop out there, I don't want to sacrifice crop. So the drone fit is the perfect fit, and you know, it just helps us maintain quality.
I'm sure we've got some listeners who want your list of what you've been using, any companies you'd recommend or any tools that you've been using that people should check out if they want to think about going down some of these paths.
Oh man, we have the robot, ROWBOT was the one we had last fall there seeding. And then this year we had Sabanto out here. That's another company that they're making autonomous, you know, traditional tractors, autonomous, I guess would be the description there. Tizo is the company that we're working with on the drones. Through the whole AgLaunch 365 deal, we've been exposed to quite a few companies that, you know, Global Neighbor, I'm going to say, is the one to watch right now. I think they've got some technology that's going to be a game changer. You know, we're supposed to have it on our combine this fall that they've got the weed destructor like you would have in Australia, but instead of a mill, they're actually using a light source technology. So it takes a lot less power. It works in a broader range of environments. You know, in Iowa here, we're pretty high humidity compared to Australia. You know, so that was been my biggest concern, like with hammer mill type deals on the back of a combine, it creates a lot of heat. You know, the more humidity you have, the worse it's going to work. But the neat part to that technology is they already have a commercial version called the Weed Erase that a homeowner can buy, and you use that same light source technology to kill weeds. They're in field test right now. They're gonna come out with a field version that in lab they were killing 0 foot tall cereal rye at 4 mile an hour. So if we can start utilizing that technology, and if you really get the chance to talk to him, he starts describing how beyond killing weeds, they can suppress weeds. So they just turn back the dial and say, hey, we want to suppress like clover for a month or clover for 2 months. They just turn the dial back, stun that clover. Boom, you got cover crop that's perennial. And, you know, instead of cover crop every year, you can just keep maintaining that. You know, and that's what we've been trying, but I've killed a lot of good cover crop trying to learn. Then the other thing, like in the fall after harvest, you'd be able to use that same technology, go over your field and it would germinate the weed seeds that are on top. So it's like all of a sudden you got a three-season tool. That's how you make stuff pay. Mm. I talked about, you know, once we figured out how to build stuff that you can use more than one season, you know, one of the things I've got accused, you know, they're like, well, for no more acres in your farm, how do you justify the equipment you have? Well, we use more than one season a year. You know, you make it so it's adaptable. You simple, you know, like my drill, I just changed the monitor and boom, I can go from fertilizer to seeding to, you know, broadcast or whatever you want to do. We with minor changes, we can do pretty, you know, that tool. Well, when I was at 750 acres, that tool was going over 3,000 acres a year and no custom work. So, you know, it gets some serious acres on it, even though we don't have the acres to farm. But, you know, I've also got to the point where I don't want to farm the world. So, you know, if I can do a better job, what we're doing, that's where I'm at.
And keeping it fun, it sounds like as well, which is increasingly, I mean, must be super exciting to have your daughters thinking about coming back and taking over that. That must be, you must be really proud.
The biggest challenge there is going to be, you know, the son-in-law, they farm very sizable acres. I guess I'll put it that way. If we can have a little impact, you know, I'm not going to try to tell them guys how to farm, you know, and I've told them, you know, his parents need to know I'm never going to condemn how they farm. Because I respect what they've done. You know, his dad's the same age as I am. We were good friends growing up and all that. I don't want it ever come off that I'm condemning the way they farm. But, you know, I know his mother's paying attention to what we're doing because, you know, they see the bills. And, you know, we're farming a fraction of what they're farming and a lot less stress. You know, but if we can have an impact and help them understand how we farm and take it to that scale, that could be, you know, that could set them kids up for a pretty good future.
And that's it for another episode of AgTech So What. A huge thanks to Lauren for chatting with me and to Connie Bowen for suggesting Lauren as a guest. And before you go, I want to let you know how you can come on the podcast. We'll be releasing our 100th episode very soon, and we want to hear from you. Head to our website, agtechsowhat.com, and you'll find an orange button on the homepage where you can hit record and leave a short message. You could tell us about whether you've been inspired by or disagree with something you've heard, share your insights about what the future of agtech might be, or tell us about your own agtech journey. You'll also be able to find links to resources mentioned in this episode on the website. I'm Sarah Nolette. Thanks for listening. Catch you next time.